Okay, we are in Ois Nun Dalid, in the Maimar Sheni, and the discussion here, a discussion which in this Maimar began, at least in the recent part of the Maimar, surrounded upon the place of Klal Yisrael among the Umay Sa'ilam, the mashal of Klal Yisrael to the heart of the world, compared to the rest of the Umay Sa'ilam, and to try to give a picture of the place of Klal Yisrael, and from that, the idea of Yisrael Asher Bacha Espoer, that Kaviyachul God takes pride in Klal Yisrael. The king said that he didn't know exactly why God took pride in Klal Yisrael. There are many other things in the Bria that are more incredible. And the example that was cited was the sun. The sun is the most incredible of God's creations. It gives life to the whole world, to everything in the world. It gives warmth and heat and light and plants. It gives food, sustenance to everything. And he said that the sun, the Bries HaShemesh, is the most incredible of the creations. So why would it say about Klal Yisrael, Yisrael Asher Bacha Espoer? And to that, yesterday I began Nun Dalid, where the Chaver made his response. He said, "Haloi ar halavava is yaser dakum ula mi ar harais." It's a very beautiful expression. He says, "The heart, the light of the heart, is a more incredible creation than the light of the world and the physical light. The fact that the heart sheds light or sheds clarity or sheds gives understanding to things in the world. That's a more incredible creation than the ar hachama." And he explains, "Haloi hayu kolan she'haylam bi'ivarayin ubetolus kaida b'nei Yisrael," that the entire world was bi'ivarayin in blindness, ubetolus tos with a tof is a lashon of straying, toisi kaseh oived, ubetolus kaida b'nei Yisrael. Before the Jewish people came, the humanity struggled to understand its origins. Ulasi hayichidim. Except those individuals you mentioned earlier. Now he divides the theories that preceded Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov as to how the world came about into the five groups that we find in Tanakh, some of them in the Rishayim, the idea of what the original theories were as to the world. And he says, he's referring here to what we call the steady state theory. Those who believe the world always existed, there is no creator. There's no part of the world that is more a creator than a creation, and therefore everything always existed. So that's the theory of Olam Kadmain.
It's already mentioned. Time or heaven?
Right. Right, this was the theory that existed. The Greeks really had, Aristotle had this idea that the world always existed. What does that do for you? Well, why does believing the world always existed? Like, what does it do? Yeshkecha did exist, didn't exist. What it does, there's no creator and there's no responsibility. There's no achrayus. Now, I mentioned to you, this is the first group, and in a way, it's the last group. It's a group that existed until fairly recently, where modern science believed in the steady state theory, things always existed. Until, as I mentioned to you, Hubble's discoveries were given credit, and it often happens with scientists, after his death, his theories were accepted, and by the 60s and 70s, the world began to agree that there was a genesis, a beginning, and that's what we call the Big Bang Theory. Now, I want to mention, just to give a picture of where we are, that the world is bouncing back, so to speak. The idea that the world always existed, which to believing people, the idea the world existed forever is just pushing away the question. You might as well say you don't know. Because the world always existed forever, is still where did it come from? It didn't come from anywhere, it just always existed. So that theory, it sounds a little strange. I once mentioned to you the introduction to his the turtle story in terrible names, in The Brief History of Time. He has this introduction, the turtle's theory, how some fool was asked, some ancient man was asked, what does the world stand on? He said, well, on a turtle, on a very big turtle. He said, well, what is the big turtle standing on? He said, well, under the big turtle is even a bigger turtle. And that turtle stands on. He said, okay, so what is that? He said, a bigger turtle. He said, well, what does that stand on? He says, you don't understand. There's turtles all the way down. There's turtles all the way down. So that's the steady state theory. There's turtles all the way down. So therefore, there was no beginning. There's no end. And that's the theory. So today, scientists became smarter and they said there's a Big Bang theory and there was a beginning. Trying to explain the Big Bang Theory. Now the truth is, if you've read more recently, the Big Bang Theory is going back to the steady state theory, because now scientists want to understand the idea of cycles, of expanding and contracting universes. Right? The universe expands until it reaches its limit of expansion, and then it contracts and falls back. Someday everything's going to squash right back down into one squashed little ball. And then it's going to explode again. There's going to be an expanding universe. And when it stops expanding, it's going to come back and contract again. Now, why anybody would put all the effort into... I mean, anybody who says this is only saying that's a possibility. No one, obviously, there are no videos of the original contraction or the expansion. The only reason to say such a thing is to go back to the steady state theory and ignore the beginning. Because then it was forever. It just kept on... Just turtles all the way down.
It reverses it, you know.
What?
Inertia pushes things, keeps going at the same speed, right? What, okay. Inertia all of a sudden makes a U-turn?
They can scientifically explain the possibility. The possibility can be explained that there's a limit to expansion. It can't be proven, it can only be, it turns around. But the question is philosophically, scientifically, it's possible. But philosophically, why would anybody want to do that? Like, well, what's the problem? The universe is expanding. Now, in order to be able to say it expands forever and contracts forever, you have to pick extraordinary numbers because in order, the world changes very slowly, and in order to allow for evolution, everything to happen, you have to have gigantic numbers. Then the expansion you have to have some gigantic number, and then some gigantic number of contraction, and it just boggles the mind why people would do it. The only reason to do it is to go back to the idea of the steady state theory that everything always existed, to avoid saying there was a beginning. So if you say there's a beginning, then there had to be a beginner, there had to be something that started it going, and that theory today, it's in one form or another, it's in vogue. It's really just them's turtles all the way down, which is the language that the same scientists used to make fun of those who believe in the steady state theories. Now, instead of turtles all the way down, it's expansions and contractions all the way down. It's really not much of a difference. So that idea, he calls the first sort of theory of the world. And then he says there's a second group. There are those who believe that the heavenly orbits our God. In other words, man looked towards the heavens, and man said, well, there are incredible things going on up there, stars and the sun, the moon, the stars. There was a Gilgal, the Greek model of the universe. It has the earth as a stationary middle, sort of like a ping pong ball. Let's say the earth is imagined a ping pong ball, and around it a tennis ball. That tennis ball is a transparent circle that turns in the sky, and the different stars are a turning cycle in the sky. Now, that can't be, because the sun doesn't fit with the other stars. All the stars turn in the same rotation. If you watch the sky, nobody looks at the sky today, all those guys turn the same rotation. You can picture it. But the sun doesn't go with that rotation. The sun has its own mind of its own. So they pictured another ball that had the sun, another ball that had the moon. So that there were, according to the way the Rambam brings the Greek belief, there were eight spheres to account for all the possible movements. Now those spheres are God. That's God. Now, why is that God any more than a mouse? Only because it's so far away and so mystical and mysterious that it could be God.
What is God? Spheres?
The spheres are what brought creation to the world, according to this theory. When I say God, I mean creator. What created everything? The heavenly bodies. They attributed some sort of a wisdom or a deity to the heavenly bodies. Now, what's interesting is that the Rambam, it's appropriate for Parshas Noach, Parshas Noach, the Rambam explains how this idea came around. The Rambam is the beginning of the Savai Dazar. I think it's a well-known Rambam. He says, how did it start? Adam knew there was a creator. And he certainly told his children and his grandchildren. And he lived almost 1,000 years, 930 years. Like, where did it start? So the Rambam says, "Bimei enosh tov b'nei adam tov es gadol." It started with the following error that people made. V'zuhay setu usam. Amru. Hayol v'likim barak echavim elu. V'lgal galim. L'hanig esayilam. It says, God created the stars, the orbits, the spheres that circle the world. V'nosam b'maray. V'chaluk lahem kavid. And he gave honor to the heavenly bodies. And they're God's servants that serve him. So we believe in a creator. Adam taught us there was a creator. Adam had no father. And therefore, we believe in a creator. But a Kadosh Baruch Hu put the sun in the sky. Why do you put the sun in the sky? To warm us and to give us light. So it's like a president who appoints a secretary of state. So the sun is the secretary of state. We should give honor to the president's secretary of state. That is God's will. Just like any king wants that we give honor to those who stand before them. This is the first step to what happened. And he says, if as time passed, there are those who came along and said, so they still believed in a creator, but they said, God wants that you don't pray to God. Pray to my, don't send me in petitions. Send it to my secretary. Let the secretary take care of the petitions. And therefore they gave honor. They made surahs, they made forms to represent those heavenly bodies. The Rambam goes on, it's a bit of a richus in the Rambam, but he basically says that with the passage of time, the president was forgotten. And the minister who administers to their needs is what was remembered, and that's how this whole thing evolves. It's a long Rambam. It's the first parak in Lechazav HaDazar. It's very appropriate, but very appropriate, especially for these parashiyos. He says that's how Avodah Zarah started. Avodah Zarah began with saying that the heavenly bodies are in service of God, which they are in service of God, but they deserve their own honor. And that, in turn, became a godliness for the heavenly bodies. So that's the second group. That was the second group. Now, it's very strange, when the Torah speaks about Achras Hayamim, the Torah speaks about people, when Mashiach comes, who believe in Avodah Zarah. We believe in Avodah Zarah, and we know today that when Mashiach comes, nobody believes in idol worship today. Nobody. You always find some groups that do things, but for the most part, human beings don't believe in idol worship. What? I don't know if all the Indians believe in idol worship or not, but there may be some, but it's certainly not the multitudes of humanity that believe in it. Well, there are quite a billion Indians. A billion is still a high number. A billion Chinese, there are no billion Indians. But the Chinese don't believe in idol worship. Anyway, the point, Rav Hutner makes a point in his Pachad Yitzchak that the Torah always talks about two groups of Avodah Zarah: the idol worshippers and those who serve the heavenly bodies. They're two separate sort of groups of idol worshippers. The idol worship of the heavenly bodies in today's day and age is using the heavens as the source of kfira. The heavens today are used as the source for all apikorsis. All the monies that are spent by NASA in exploring the heavens is really, what are they looking for? They're just looking for an alternative. They're looking for the origin, that's what they say, for the origin. They're looking back in time for the origin, which no one's going to find. They're not going to find any origin because it's going to come up with new theories. Instead of clarity, they have more and more theories. The point, though, is that even if idol worship is gone, the worship of the heavens is very much alive and well. And not that they believe, as he says, that the Galgal does things, but that it has in it the secrets of the origin of the world. And the third group, Am Acher Tayin, Shoeishu Etzem. What?
No, let's say they don't know, but they search. Is it wrong something? What they search? The nature of reality?
It's nice to have objective search for things, but it depends what they're searching for. And there's nothing wrong with searching, but the whole search is predicated on a search for an alternative to God rather than what reality are they looking for? What are they looking for in the heavenly bodies? Trying to look back in time.
They look for life forms.
Well, they're not, at this moment, they're not looking for alternative life forms. They're looking to understand the heavens. The black holes are an understanding of how the heavens work. And I would think science is good. I would think that there would be better expenditures for massive amounts of money than theories which are, by definition, not provable. Neither practical nor provable. There's nothing provable, nothing practical. All it creates is questions. The search of the heavens creates questions and therefore new theories. And since people only get paid if they create theories, there's not going to be an end. There's not theories that can be proven. The theories that will keep on having babies. You know, they're going to keep on having new theories. That's just the way, just as the nature of riddles, of a riddle that has no definite answer. And my point is not to talk about the cosmology, the theories of how the cosmos came about, but to say that what he's talking about here, the steady-state theory, is the first group, and the group that looks to the heavens, today I don't think anybody believes the heavens created us, but nevertheless, it exists. The third group, Sha'eshu Etzem Ha'or, V'amaisim Ha'chazakam Ha'mufloim. Fire doesn't necessarily mean a visible fire, it means the warmth, the power of a fire is the source of everything. It's worth serving the fire, and that the essence of man is fire. That's the Moilech, that's the Avodah Zarah Moilech, which is the least physical of the observable so-called physical things in the world. The observable things, fire, he can't pick up fire, he can't grab it. Besides, that's too hot to grab, even if it wasn't hot. You can't grab fire, you can't hold on to it. It's the most spiritual of everything. And therefore, there was this idea that fire is the essence of a human being. And again, I mentioned to you in the past, the idea that chamimus, or energy, is the essence of everything, again, is an ancient theory, but it's alive and well. Because today, in physics, we understand that everything only exists because of movement. If there was no movement of the small particles of mass that exist, then there'd be no table and no chair and nothing could exist. We understand that every atom is just basically movement of very minute particles. So the idea of chamimus being part of the origin of the world has some essence of truth. The fourth group, Am Acher, others choose within nature different things to serve. You mentioned in India the idea that certain animals may have special properties. Very hard to understand this group. And the fifth group, the last group, they choose human beings and attribute some type of godliness to human beings. And they all agree that the world functions in a certain constant way. Now, I just want to say, those who served human beings, it's hard, again, for us to understand today, the idea of the divine right of kings, which was a staple of human morality for so many centuries, is very hard today to understand. We learned about it in school, but we just read about it like it's such a strange thing. What does it mean? And yet, even in the 1800s, the kings certainly believed in the divine right of kings, and they believed that if the Tsar's family was the Hasidim, if you're a descendant of the Tsar's family, you have a divine right to run the world. Until the end of World War II, was it? Yeah. So it's funny today, it's, what? We don't believe it's a divine right. We believe kings have only responsibilities. The Navi says to the king, to be a king is to be an Eved Lamazah. It's responsibility, it's not rights. The king doesn't have rights. He can't, I'm allowed to have as much money as I want. The king is limited. The king is... What power? Which power do they have? It's responsibility to run the world. Not if you're Mayor B'Malchus, but that's only to the degree that the king runs the world. The king runs the country. But it depends on what royalty is. Royalty is not godliness. Royalty by the Klai Yisrael is not godliness. It's not. It's a responsibility. Kuna is also not transferable. But... So at any rate, Arash Philosophim Ashadoki Yunam, Vizakamach Shaftam, Bahidu Basiba Rishinis in a Daimul Shahadvar. Until those who had some type of deeper understanding agreed to the idea of a Siba Rishina, in the Aitzadechbad he brings from the Mar Nevuchim what the logical sequence of thoughts would be to believe in a God or in a creator. He says, "Eina daima l'shar advarim notu bi kishusam she'ein lo ma'isa ba'olam kolshkei mechalokiyais." Even the later Greeks who believed in a creator believed that the creator had no interest in the world anymore. Shemiraimim ma'isaim avdilanaisai miyadiyasam, that God is so great and so lofty that he's not involved in the world. And certainly he's not interested in influencing the world. Until Klal Yisrael came along. Until Klal Yisrael came along, a nation to whom God saw fit to do miracles. And they saw openly that the world has not only a creator, but someone who's hands-on, who's knowledgeable of every part of creation, he gives reward and punishment, and this, and Klal Yisrael is the cause for the Yashus Halavavis, the hearts looking to God. And therefore, the Muslims and the Christians who came later built on the Yisaidais that Klal Yisrael shone on the world. Till we come to a world today where he says, all those who dwell in the world, you know that kol in Hebrew does not mean 100%, does not mean all. The Taz writes of Shulchan Aruch, the kol and kulai together, kol ha'ilam kulai, means absolutely everybody. Kol by itself doesn't mean 100% of everybody, it means the overwhelming majority. Maidim b'chidush ha'ilam, or b'kadmus l'bayri ha'ilam, or maivsam alzeh b'nei Yisrael. And their examples, Klal Yisrael, mashanas aleihem, or mashanigzar aleihem. So that, in speaking to the king, the Chavar points out, that this R that he's talking about, Klal Yisrael, it's really Klal Yisrael is a small family within the family of nations, a small group. And the ideas that Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov taught us are ideas that have taken over most of the world. And the understanding that the five theories that we mentioned are incorrect, that all comes from Klal Yisrael. And the Kuzri says, Zeh Pe'er Gadol. Yisrael, Asher B'chai Espoyer, now makes sense. That Kosh Baruch takes pride in Klal Yisrael. Now, now it follows. And that is what the Kuzari and then the Chavar again are going to continue about. And again, the point is the uniqueness of Klal Yisrael among the nations. We'll pick up on it next week. I'll begin.